Hi, my name is Taco. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we need your help to solve a mystery. It's about something that happened in Nova Scotia during the filming of the James Cameron film, Titanic.
I mean, there was an emergency room with no one in it and like a nurse, and 85 crew members walk in. We don't know. We think we've had shellfish poisoning.
Wait for that. Today's show is a little bit different. Normally, when a reporter here is working on an investigation, you don't hear about it until it's done. Might take months. Sometimes it's taken years. But today, for a change, we're going to pull back the curtain on a work in progress. Our reporter, Julian Abraham, has been trying to solve this mystery for the past 6 months. And he has had some breakthroughs, but he is still looking for the final piece of the puzzle. And it occurred to him, one of you might have it. The mystery that he's trying to solve is by now a piece of Canadian film industry lore. It has been whispered about and speculated on for decades. Lots of people have theories, but so far, nobody has provided a conclusive answer. As you may know, parts of the blockbuster film Titanic were filmed in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. And on the last night of filming there, someone did something. Something that caused director James Cameron to question reality itself. Something that resulted in the rest of the cast and crew being piled into vans and rushed to a tiny nearby hospital. The cops looked into it, but they ultimately never figured out who was responsible. Well, nearly 30 years later, Julian picked up the investigation where the police left off. And if you know something, he needs your help. So he is going to introduce you to this mystery. He's going to tell you a little bit of what we know so far. And if you have any information about this story, he wants you to email him at julian@canadaland.com. You can also email me at jesse@canadaland.com. So, what is this mystery? Wait for it.
I first heard about this story a decade ago. Before I was with Canada Land, and before I was even thinking about journalism as a career. It was around 2013. I was still an undergrad and had a side hustle as a small-time actor. For the uninitiated, that's Trailer Park Boys. And you may know me from Canada Land, but I'm going to go on a limb and guess you do not know me from my time as Mall Cop 2 in Trailer Park Boys Season 8.
You cop wannabe.
Dennis, unload!
Oh, you must!
That doesn't f***ing me! Oh, you son of a
Anyone with ties to Nova Scotia knows the Trailer Park Boys are a big part of the province's film industry. And the group of people who work on this and other productions in the area, well, it's a small world. One day that summer, and I remember because I was especially sleepy from the 5 a.m. call time, I got chatting with some Canadian film industry veterans. They were all sitting around telling stories. For example, one of the guys worked on My Bloody Valentine. It's a horror movie shot in the mines of Cape Breton. He said it was claustrophobic, dark, and dangerous. It was a fictional horror movie, but he said on that set he felt real fear. Another crew member chimed in, said on another shoot, I can't remember what the name of the movie was, but apparently some of the crew got sick from eating moose meat. And then Titanic came up. Everyone was there, and if they weren't, they wanted to be there. It was huge. From what I understand, if you were in the film industry when James Cameron came to town that year, you were more than likely going to get a good gig out of this. It was a huge production. In August of 1996, they were all set to wrap. The last day was supposed to be celebratory, the end of a long stretch of work. But as we're going to get into, that is not how the day will be remembered. they filmed a few parts of the Titanic in Dartmouth, mainly the modern-day ones, the ones involving the treasure hunters, like when they pull up the safe from the bottom of the ocean floor.
Oh, baby, baby, are you seeing this, boss?
Well, on the very last day of filming in Nova Scotia, someone single-handedly brought this $200 million production to a screeching halt. And not unlike the real Titanic, it happened in the middle of the night. It sparked a police investigation, rumors of gang involvement, and cast suspicion on the production company's rivals. So naturally, nearly 30 years later, I tracked down some people who worked on Titanic and took a trip to Halifax to talk to them and try and get some answers. Fast forward to now, 2025, I tracked down some of the people who worked on Titanic and took a trip to Halifax to talk to them.
My place.
Wow.
My hiding place.
This is Marilyn McAvoy. I found her in her art studio downtown. She's a visual artist, taught art for 43 years, but back in 1996, she was a scenic painter for hire and got a call from one of James Cameron's people.
I had been given the assignment of being the standby or the on-set painter for the shoot here.
A lot of her work on Titanic involved what's called aging down. This is when you take a prop for the movie and basically make it look older. Do you remember that scene we mentioned earlier where Bill Paxton pulled up the safe? Marilyn was actually the person who painted it to look muddy, rusty, and put fake barnacles on the safe to show that it spent 84 years at the bottom of the ocean. She was there on the set of Titanic that night in 1996, working out of a big warehouse building on the Dartmouth waterfront. She's going to tell you what happened.
So everything was just normal, but it was our last day. We would start at 5 in the afternoon. And we would work all through the night because it was night scenes. Everything was just normal until midnight when we wrapped for lunch. I think there was a lot of happiness because they were wrapping up the first, you know, small section of this amazingly massive movie. It's a celebratory kind of thing because it was unusual for everyone to eat together.
This is true, and if you ever need an ego check, I suggest getting a low-ranking job on a film shoot. You can't sit with the main cast, you can't eat with them, definitely not before them, and sometimes, no joke, you're not even allowed to look at them. You know that scene in Titanic when Leo puts on a tux and dines in first class?
You never know what hand you're going to get dealt next. You learn to take life as it comes at you. Away you go, Cal.
That's kind of the feeling they had that night. It was the last night of filming in Nova Scotia, and the rules of hierarchy didn't seem to apply. Cameron was going to join. Bill Paxton, that's the actor who played the treasure hunter, he was going to join. Things felt different that night. Oh, and by the way, Leo and Kate were not there because their scenes weren't filmed in Nova Scotia.
It was kind of going around the crew that everyone was going to join in because we only had maybe, what, 5 more hours of shooting, and then we were done here. Like the last time that we had a chance to sit down and have food together.
So after that last scene of the night wrapped, Marilyn and everyone else headed across the parking lot to where dinner was being served. It was in one of those tents like you'd see at a wedding.
They had like this massive table set up and there was just all this amazing food. And the word around was that there was like a really great chowder. It was like a special for tonight. You guys got to have the best chowder you've ever had in your life. Everyone basically sat down and had this really lovely midnight lunch together, and the food was amazing. The chowder was amazing. Everything seemed like it was tickety-boo, and then we got back to shooting. I went back to set, and I remember somebody coming towards me with a lab jacket, a lab coat, a really new, bright lab jacket. And they said, we need this aged down. And I remember suddenly having a bit of a, what's the word? Just, it's like I couldn't figure it out. Like my brain was suddenly like, do I go upstairs or do I go over there and there's another sink over there? Like it was really bizarre because it's something that you would normally just not even have to think twice about. I'm like, whoa, what's going on with me? Like this is really weird. I'm getting even more confused. And finally, I see people walking outside. So I finally stopped what I was doing and I wandered over. And by that point in time, like most of the crew was out there. And I'm like, everyone's like, what is going on? What is happening to us? And not that much longer after that, there formed these two lines. It was so bizarre. So there was the good line, and then there was the bad line. And when people started feeling really not themselves, they would go, that's it, I'm definitely being affected by something. And they would walk across to the bad line.
Director James Cameron was in the bad line.
Some people were laughing. Some people were like, whoa, this is really scary. It was really obvious at that point in time that there was something that we were all being affected by. I remember, I think it was like the first AD was just like, that's it, get the vans, load everybody up who's not feeling well, and we're going to the hospital. We piled into these vans and we were driven to the Dartmouth Hospital.
The nearest hospital was Dartmouth General. And even by today's standards, after being remodeled and expanded, it's not huge. It's not like a world-class facility. They were not exactly prepared for a potential mass casualty situation. So one of the first things they did was call the police. I actually got my hands on that police report. It took cops a little while to do tox reports, but when those came back, the result was this. The seafood chowder had a secret ingredient, the drug phencyclidine, also known as PCP, also known as angel dust. And it wasn't just some little microdose of this. It was a pretty hefty one, and people were high out of their minds. Here's James Cameron talking about it on CBC's Q in 2023.
The chowder got laced with PCP. This is true?
Let me tell you, you haven't lived until you've been high on PCP, which, by the way, I do not recommend to anyone, even stoners. Basically, somebody had taken a pound of PCP and dumped it into the chowder. Of course, the operant theory was that I was such a psychomaniac that they were trying to get back at me, but I reject that theory out of hand for obvious reasons.
So all these years later, my question is probably the same one you have. What the hell happened here? Who did this? Why did they do it? And how have they managed to get away with it for so long? I've been looking into this for about 6 months now, and I found some really interesting stuff. Without showing my hand too much, I'm going to explain just a few of the most popular theories. Theory one, a rogue cook or caterer. This is a theory that someone involved in the preparation of the food put the drug in the chowder. Some versions of this say it was a cook who was fired from the catering company, or a separate cook who had access to the food through the military base where it was stored at.
I just remember hearing something about a cook, like some speculation about a cook that had been fired or something like that.
Theory number two, bikers. There's rumors about one or two men on set driving motorcycles disrupting the filming with the sounds of the revving of their engines. According to this theory, they were asked to leave, upset about it, and got vengeance by drugging the chowder. Theory number three, copper thieves. This rumor, and this is a common one, goes that two people on the film crew were caught stealing copper from the set to sell it for profit. They were fired, according to this theory, but in the last week of filming, when there was no time to find replacements for them. According to this theory, they were basically told they'd never work again, but they still had to finish up the week. According to this rumor, they were angry, which I guess kind of makes sense, and allegedly, they did the PCP thing as an act of revenge. Theory number four, sabotage. This one puts forward the idea that 20th Century Fox was stretching itself thin, going over budget, and doing whatever it took to finish Titanic, which, at this point, was the most expensive film ever made, at $200 million. This theory puts forward the idea that another film company was trying to ruin or at least cause problems for the movie. Ultimately, the police were never able to press any charges. The official investigation as it stands now was kind of a failure. Nobody got caught. One of the big reasons the Halifax Regional Police cited was the transient nature of the production. It was the last night of filming in the province, and then everyone jetted back to LA or the next location in Mexico within the coming days. There was a lot of people they wanted to talk to, but they were now scattered across the continent, and there weren't a lot of cell phones around at this point. So that is just some of the theories. There's more. I wish so bad I could tell you about the rest of them right now. I wish I could tell you everything I know, but I can't because we'll get sued. But you can see why these people on the set of Trailer Park Boys were still talking about this all these years later, right? I find it fascinating. I want to solve this thing, and this is where you come in. If you know anything about this case, no matter how big or how small, please, please, please send me an email, julian@candleland.com. We want to solve this thing, and maybe you can help. That is your CanadaLand for today. Once again, if you have any information for Julian, email him, please, at julian@canadaland.com. Today's show was reported by Julian Abraham. Bruce Thorson is our senior producer. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. This episode was fact-checked by Lucy Lomanier. Max Collins is our director of audio. I am CanadaLand's editor and publisher. Our theme music is by SoCal. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
I'm Sam Graywall, and today we're talking about the news. We'll be talking about problems with property taxes in the Niagara region. We'll be talking about RFK Jr.'s obsession with autism and vaccines. But mostly, we'll be talking about Carney's cost-cutting, Doug Ford's demand that workers return to the office, and the general state of employment in this country, especially for younger Canadians.
What Carney is proposing here really mirrors a lot of what Trump did.
Wait for that. Welcome back to the show, Stacey Thomas, senior journalist at Canadian HR Reporter with a focus on many things labor.
Thank you so much, San. I'm really happy to be here.
Prime Minister Mark Carney's planned public service cuts are raising new questions over how jobs and services are going to be affected across the country.
The essence of this is to spend less and invest more. That means reining in government spending so that Canada can invest more as a country.
These percentage spending reductions, these are identify the cuts, not implement the cuts, at least not right away.
All federal ministers are being asked to find billions of dollars in savings within their departments and agencies. By August, they need to be ready to present their plans to reduce operational spending ahead of Prime Minister Mark Carney's first budget this fall.
Stacey, back in July, Prime Minister Mark Carney made it clear to public workers that there would be a tightening of the belt, and the workers would be the ones to pay for it. Ministers were told to save 15% from their departmental budgets over the next 3 years. The deadline to do so is next week, August 28th. What that looks like in practice is pretty bleak. By 2028, more than 57,000 full-time equivalent workers will be laid off in the federal public service. Nearly half of those in the National Capital Region, so in and around Ottawa, this is going to be devastating. Almost 60,000 lost federal public service jobs would be like laying off more than a third of Ontario's auto workers. And while some senior employees might be targeted, in my opinion, if they use seniority, the move will likely impact a lot of younger workers, including women and visible minority staff, newcomers who have entered the federal workforce more recently. The layoffs are supposedly being used to offset the cost of hiring at the RCMP and significantly the Department of National Defense budget, which is set for like massive increases. A big chunk of the layoffs to support all of that are happening at the Canada Revenue Agency, Employment and Social Development, as well as Citizenship and Immigration. PSAC, the Public Service Alliance of Canada, the union representing federal employees, put out the following release about a month ago. Quote, Canada's public service isn't a piggy bank we can dip into whenever the government wants to fund new projects. We've always been open to working with the government to find savings, but we need a government that is truly willing to work with workers and unions, not around them. Cutting jobs means cutting services, full stop. It means longer wait times for passports, parental benefits, and EI checks, shuttered programs, and a government that can't deliver for people in Canada. I should disclose that the Public Service Alliance of Canada has been a sponsor of Canada Land in the past, though they aren't currently a sponsor. Stacey, just your knee-jerk response when you first heard this news.
We look south of the border and think about what Donald Trump did, but what Carney is proposing here is really mirrors a lot of what Trump did. How very Canadian this whole rollout of Carney's cuts to public service employees is, cutting public service jobs, cutting newer employees, a lot of focus on administrative departments and immigration departments, except it's just all in a much more slow and polite and very Canadian way rather than the drama and the shock with how Trump did it. And so is the coverage of the cuts. It's more polite and less dramatic.
Federal budget watchdog Yves Gigot just moments ago was saying the Carney government will need to make cuts to the public service in order to make good on its spending promises. The prime minister has long said he would only cap the public service as a way to rein in federal spending. So is that a realistic pledge?
So Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, also known as DOGE, is on a mission to dramatically reduce federal government spending. That's why you've been seeing these huge layoffs across the country of federal workers, and that's also why they've been actually trying to dismantle entire federal agencies. So Musk and Trump say that all of this is about getting rid of the waste and the bloat in the system, in the government. But how much money is actually being saved by these moves from DOGE?
Yeah, it certainly does seem like DOGE light.
Exactly. It's very similar to what we have been observing happening, just on a smaller, less dramatic scale.
I really want to focus on younger Canadians and almost philosophically delve into the reality of the workplace. So we're also going to talk about Doug Ford. He's now ordering provincial workers. I think it's about 60,000 actually will be impacted by this demand to be back in the office full-time 5 days a week by January.
The Ontario Public Service will be returning to office full-time in the coming months.
I believe everyone's more productive when they're at work. And how do you mentor someone over a phone? You can't. You got to look at them eye to eye, over the water cooler, wherever, train them, camaraderie. All the companies I've talked to, from the banks to the insurance companies, everyone needs to go back to work. I think it's just time. Everyone's kind of saying it's time to get back to work. It's simple as that.
And again, I can't help but think that in an economic and social environment where youth unemployment, it's not been this high in a long time. It reached 15% last July. And that's those Canadians up to the age of 25 who are unemployed. On Canada Land Politics, Noor spoke to a few young people who are struggling to find work.
I think I'm at about 110 job applications, and I've had two interviews.
That's a lot of job applications.
The worst part is it actually isn't. I know people who have easily tripled or quadrupled what I've done in the same time frame, probably close to 1,000 applications with no luck.
Anyone who hasn't heard that episode should do so. It's great. But back to the matter at hand. I know we've heard a lot of things about work-life balance and, oh, Gen Z and prior to that, like millennials and they're griping and blah, 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 which I don't buy into. But
neither.
Yeah. In your space, like covering the labor sector so closely, you can explain this and get into this better than anyone. But when I look at the reality for younger Canadians, I just think, thank God. If I was like 30, 35 years younger, I'd be like just out of sorts.
Youth are experiencing a crisis right now, not even talking about youth that don't have college degrees, but education isn't keeping up with what graduates need to know. They're not learning essential skills that they need to know. They're unsuccessful going into new roles because they don't know anything about how to actually work with other people, and that's not their fault. They came up in the environment that was created by us, basically. There's the issue of bias against them. I'm making air quotes right now. No one wants to work with a Gen Z. No one wants to work with a millennial because they're all whiny complainers who want too much. But the fact is they want what everybody else wants. There's been lots of research done around how Gen Z and younger, they want to be in the office more than anybody else. They want to be in that environment. They want to be learning from others. They want to have successful careers and to work, but they're not being set up for success because it's expensive to live now and they're not making enough money and their degrees aren't giving them what they need. Not even speaking about AI and technology yet, which has disrupted everything. So the skills that employers are looking for now, which is the ability to work with AI, which is all anyone seems to care about now, apparently, they're not learning that in traditional programs. Even business degrees, they're not learning the actual on-the-job skills that employers are looking for. They themselves don't feel that their degrees are valuable.
And I know there's been pop cultural references. One of the earliest ones was the film Office Space.
I generally come in at least 15 minutes late. And after that, I just sort of space out for about an hour. I just stare at my desk, but it looks like I'm working. In a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work. The thing is, Bob, it's not that I'm lazy. It's that I just don't care.
Listen, I'm going to go. It's been really nice talking to both of you guys. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, I hope your firings go really well.
Okay. Excellent. Great. Yeah.
When it was a parody and everything was exaggerated, but painting this picture of this disaffected generation and work-life balance was really a bit of a joke to a lot of younger people who just felt that the corporate world didn't really care about that balance. And as a consequence, more and more people, they just refuse to develop their identity through their work. They want different things. But I wonder, how does Mark Carney, for example, in my opinion, being so short-sighted, where you're going to strip down the federal civil service. And again, I'm not suggesting that it's all young workers that are going to be impacted, but it's clear that if they use seniority, these are union positions, it likely will be a lot of younger staff, people who've been hired more recently, who are going to be impacted. And the signal, the messaging from the Prime Minister is instead of me setting the example that there's a future here for young Canadians, that we are going to make sure there are jobs for you, that we are going to create opportunities that maybe haven't existed for the last decade or so, but we're going to change that narrative. No, that's not what he has done. He has basically set this tone. And I would argue that Doug Ford ordering workers back into the office, which is going to, again, women, young people, this is not what they want.
It's insane to me that he said that publicly. I see it as a huge slap in the face, honestly, because it's not this big secret. I don't think anybody really believes that a better work culture involves everyone being in the office 5 days a week. When was the last time you were in an office for 5 days a week, Doug Ford?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the executives and the CEOs and the C-suite folks and the Doug Fords, like the career politicians and whatnot, like Doug Ford, you go from a very controversial sort of youth to doing some work for your like family printing company to getting into politics. When have you ever worked 9 to 5 in an office?
The only messaging that we get about this, oh, working in the office is better for our company culture, it's all just comes from the top. And this is what all the banks, the financial institutions are doing in the States. And it's just counter to what all the research. And this is especially hurtful from Doug Ford in that there is a lot of really good research, Canadian research at Ontario universities